Hello and a very warm welcome to Wellness with Liz Earle. And today you are getting two topics in one, as I'm talking to the founder of the luxurious cashmere travel wrap company. And many of you actually might have seen the feature that we did on this really lovely, traditional, very high quality company in a previous issue of Liz Earle Wellbeing magazine, as well as discussing the subject of depression or anxiety during the menopause. So what is the connection, you might be asking yourself? Well, the founder of the travel wrap company, who is a qualified pharmacist, a corporate high flyer, and is also somebody who has been through anxiety and depression, or was it linked to the menopause? A very warm welcome to Niamh Barker.
Thank you, Liz.
Lovely to have you here. And in fact, we met, I think, most recently up in Scotland when we did that feature for the magazine, looking at the amazing travel wraps.
Lovely Hoik.
Being made in Hoik, or Howick, I kept calling
Hoik,
it.
But I think they call it in Scotland.
Hoik. Yes. Well, we'll come on to that, because what I want to do really is set the scene and talk about your background first. And who are you and what are you? Because you've been described as, you know, you are a pharmacist. That was your training.
I think that was such a long time ago. I'd need to go back and re-qualify, Liz.
But that's your medical background.
That was
my scientific medical background.
Yeah, I spent 4 years at Bath University and I have a degree in pharmacy. And then I worked in hospital for a couple of years in some of the London teaching hospitals. I went on from there to work for a company called Pfizer, big pharmaceutical company. And I laterally with Pfizer headed up their medical affairs. So it was for the prescription end of the business.
So serious brain.
In the UK.
Totally immersed in the medical world and, you know, prescribing of products and issues and healthcare. You know, that was your world for many, many years.
Yeah. And I tend to be very evidence driven as a result of that.
Sure.
I think.
Have to be.
I look for evidence for decision making in terms of, even in terms of, you know, managing my children's health or something. I look for good evidence.
Yeah. So that is a really interesting background. How come you are now the founder of this amazing travel wrap company, which I have to say I absolutely love?
Okay, so, 12 years ago, 17 years ago, I should go to the backstory first. So 17 years ago, I married my husband and I took on four stepchildren. And
overnight,
then
you suddenly had four children.
I suddenly had four children under seven running around. And I was still working for Pfizer at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
I came from a big Irish family, so I was used to the noise level, I always say to people. So actually, it didn't seem like such a big step. I took on these four quite little children at the time. I was still doing quite a big job for Pfizer, traveling quite a lot, very busy. And then we had our two little girls in quick succession.
So you're a mum of six suddenly, really?
Mum of six suddenly. Still working for Pfizer. Pfizer conveniently moved offices. I used to commute from the South Coast, which is where we currently live. When I worked for Pfizer and I was single, I was living in London. Then they, I moved down into Andy's home on the South Coast in the New Forest with his children. We had two of our own. Pfizer moved offices and I used that as a kind of opportunity. I think it was one of those crosses
to
in the
exit,
road
to and say, just to I, say I can't do this now.
So they give me some redundancy payment and I thought I know what I could do, rather than, you know, bringing in staff to manage all these children. My husband and I got quite busy jobs I thought I could start my own business.
Well, we'll talk about your husband's job in a moment, because that is actually relevant to part of the story.
I knew nothing about business
when
I started
on this
journey.
Okay, so why travel wrap?
I loved cashmere.
Yes,
I knew I loved cashmere. I loved really good cashmere.
Yeah.
And when I was working for Pfizer, I used to travel quite a lot, being a plane. And it's as simple as this. I used to hate those awful blankets they give you on planes.
Right.
And I'm a cold little thing. So it all kind of joined the dots, you know. And I thought, wouldn't it be lovely to have like just a really special blanket for grown-up girls? Something really special and lovely and colourful, because I love colour as well.
So how easy was it to go about finding out? Did you sort of really have to do a lot of forensic research almost? Like,
I
from
did
your background,
quite,
looking
I'm
at
quite
ingredients,
obsessive
which
about
in this
things.
Case is
so cashmere. I did do a lot. And that was, I think, that was just after Kira was born in 2005. And I was busy getting samples from Mongolia, trying to find, I mean, you know, I was using, even then, using Google to try and do lots of
research.
So
you talk about
research.
Good quality cashmere. Where does that come from? Where in the world do you get the best cashmere?
Our good quality cashmere comes from Mongolia. And
does
we
it?
Only use the longest fibres of cashmere.
From which animal?
The yarn. From the goat.
From the goat. Goat.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
And I've seen it being spun. And does it arrive in the UK in sort of bags of fibre?
It arrives raw fibre. In fact, the mill we were at, the Hoyk Mill, yeah, is the smaller end of the Johnson's, the mill that I work with. Mm. They've got another mill in East Fields. I think I've got the right name.
Oh,
right.
I think I heard about that. And that's
and
where they actually spin it.
That is where they do. Yeah. So the only mill in the UK that does this kind of all the way through the process, the vertical mill. So they go from raw yarn. And we must take you up to Eastfield someday, because actually they have big vats full of dye that you can wander around. That's where they do the dye. And that's where they spin the yarn and turn it into the cashmere.
And what's lovely actually
about
going up there is that it is a traditional mill and it is a huge source of local employment. Used to be
massive.
Many obviously have been closed over the years through cheap Asian imports. There's a lot of Chinese cashmere, isn't there? What's the difference between buying that? Because there is a huge price difference, isn't there?
I think there's two principal differences between the cashmere that we use and then the cheaper cashmere. Cheaper cashmere tends to be shorter. I talked about
shorter
longer fibres, very
okay.
short fibres. So it bobbles quite easily.
It does bobble,
and
yeah.
it kind of, it. I almost think of it as almost disposable cashmere, a couple of washes and it's not fit for purpose, really.
Yeah.
And the other thing we get with our lovely travel wraps and our lovely cashmere and the other products that our mill make is this depth of colour. So we talk about a melange of cashmere, which means sort of layer upon layer of colour, and you get this richness and depth, and you can see it in our travel wraps. There's a kind of character and
almost jewel coloured, aren't they? Real sort
beautiful.
Of ruby colours.
Absolutely.
And for anybody who missed it, we actually got together and made a Lizelle Wellbeing travel wrap, which had our lovely shades of dark, vibrant pink. And it just goes so well. And you have another one, which I've actually bought many years ago, and I still use almost on a daily basis, which is bright pink. And I like wearing pink next to my face because I find it reflects up into my skin and gives you that natural, rosy, healthy glow. Mm. So I'm all for using great colour.
Oh, and colour is such an important part of what I do. I mean, it's quite interesting. When I started this business, I knew nothing about business. I knew lots about drugs, I always say to people.
Okay. Maybe you needed them after you started the business.
I knew nothing about business, which was, I think in some ways it's an easier way to start a business because you don't know what you don't know.
Otherwise you'd be terrified.
But I started by designing up these lovely travel wraps, that were all full of colour and design and ambition. And it took me months to do, I think, the first two designs. But of course, within that you need some neutrals and commercially viable colours as well.
Yeah.
But I did start with these lovely, vibrant, stripy, fantastic designs.
And you have done unbelievably well. You are probably one of the market leaders, or if not the market leader in the area. Is it very competitive?
I tell you what we are, Liz. We are the first to market. So we're the original travel wrap.
Okay, so that's always a good point, isn't it?
Which
of anything
is,
to be
which
the original.
Is because, and the trouble with travel wrap as a brand name is just two words joined together. So you can't get IP, which is intellectual protection, on two words joined together.
Yes.
So I did think about that in the early days, but I thought we don't want anything with Neve Barker in it, because my father's still working out how to spell my name. So
I should say Niamh is spelled N-I-A-M-H.
N-I-A, yes. And Daddy still mixes up the A and the I. Bless him. I hope he's not listening.
Well, if your father gets it wrong, then what hope
my
is
father
there
gets
us?
It wrong. And you have to speak probably Gaelic to be able to understand and pronounce it to start with. In fact, when I was born, it was spelled N-I-A-M Fada, which is the old-fashioned Irish.
Oh my goodness.
But I think that would have just driven me to distraction.
So they do say that when you're branding products, you need to make your brand name
so
really
remember,
clear
and
spellable, especially for search engines
completely.
These days.
And people find it. And I remember that moment in my kitchen, Sunday lunch, and we were both, my husband and I were there, and I think we'd come up, I'd sort of worked through a few names for this company that was just coming into being, and I thought, posh cashmere company, disregard.
Polarizing.
And, travel blanket, it's too hard, it's not elegant enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, I know what we can call it, travel wrap. There's an elegance and a comfort and a loveliness with that.
It does what it says on the tin, doesn't it?
So we So we literally, I came up with the concept and thing. So we can, we still talk about the original traveler app being ours.
Yeah, which is your USP, I guess, and the quality, as you say, and the colours. And you are hugely well connected. I mean, it's been said that Prince George even has his own.
Prince George has his own traveler.
Which is, you know, that is really, I'm hopeful of your royal warrant coming soon.
Well, that would, I think you
But how did you reach such high profile clientele? Because I know a lot of people listening will perhaps be running their own small businesses or be thinking, I'd love to do that. How did you set about doing that, getting the name out?
Some of it by default, because people like yourself, they find us and they like us and they're recommended. It's kind of word of mouth stuff.
Sure.
I think the other thing is I'm just obsessively driven.
You love your product.
So I'm like a little Rottweiler. I wouldn't be very good at mobile phones, Liz, but I'm very good at travel wraps and very good at cashmere. And what I used to do back in the early days when we didn't have PR and I'd go into the Sunday Times Business, I'd find the name of a journalist and I would dig down and find an email that journalist
and
I would keep almost to the point that I'd go and knock on his office door, you know. Yeah. I would just keep digging, keep reaching out, keep networking. I mean, I think people have this idea that, you know, an internet company, you're sitting in your little office, you're working from just a small space and you're not connecting with people.
Well, you could be, but that
could
isn't
be,
how it
wouldn't
happens.
Get very no. far, you no. know. So I reached out and anybody higher along the kind of business journey than I was, you know, if I had to, you know, drive to London and manage three kids in the afternoon, I'd make sure that happened. So
now, of course,
I did all of that and I kept reaching out and connecting with people, and I think that helped.
And is it all credit to you, because that was, how long ago did you start the business?
10 years.
So you know, a few years ago, and you are what age now, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm scarily 52.
52, very youthful looking. Those of you who hop on Instagram or look at our podcast notes and you'll see pictures, and Neve does not look 52.
I drink a lot of water.
Excellent, yes, and other things.
And other things, yes.
So you have six small children. You have
not anymore, but
no,
I did.
No, but at the
time. At the
time, you have a business, and you are in your mid-40s, mid to late 40s. So how are you feeling around then? How was it affecting your health?
When I started the business and I was juggling the kids, you know, it was quite funny actually, because you used to get these, I don't know if they still come and visit you after you've had a baby, you know, these occupational what are they called,
health visitors
type role, and they'd come and see me and they'd do this little questionnaire on kind of depression or something.
Sure.
I suppose it was related to postnatal depression. And they'd say, you know, are you less happy than you were? And do you have less fun and less sleep? And I'd be thinking, really? Are you serious? Of course I could, you know, I could tick every single box.
Yeah.
So relative to my singleton life in London, where I'd be wandering down the King's Road on a Saturday afternoon, you know, meeting some girlfriends. And of course it was different and it was busy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, health-wise, I was fine. I've always kept healthy. I've always exercised.
Because you're a runner, aren't you?
I'm a runner. I wasn't then, but I discovered running. I'm like an ex-smoker with my running now.
I run
now obsessively, but I didn't run.
So what age did you start running?
I probably started running. It was only when I moved to the Forest. I wasn't a runner when I was in London. So, you know, maybe 45 something.
That
was after I had my children.
Interesting, because I'm a late starter. I don't run like you. I don't run very fast and I don't run very far.
But I do
get out there. So how far do you run?
I do half marathons.
Neve, that is...
No, but I don't do it every... You know, I run... I tell you the other thing, Liz, I don't get time to run.
No,
so
but
I
you
have
could.
To find...
Hats off to you.
I find a way. So we have a little treadmill in... I mean, we call it the gym. It's not a gym. It's a shed in the garden. And if I can't get out for a run, which I can't do most days because I'm trying to, you know, get up, run, read, get the kids out to school, all of those things that we all have to do. I'll go and do even 10 minutes.
Yeah, it is. It's so true. I have the same.
And I think running for me, it's interesting because I usually put on weight when I'm fit and I run. I just get stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't run to lose weight. I run to keep myself mentally and physically fit.
Well, and there is that huge
connection,
isn't there, between exercise
and we'll come back to that with the menopause, which is how I...
Yes.
Think I helped myself a bit, and I think there's a, you know, you can certainly there's help out there, and you can get you can get lots of help if you look in the right places. But I think I read a lot, and I could see that exercise for example, helps with night sweats, I think.
Yes.
And so I found this article on high intensity exercise and night sweats. And I thought, I need to do that. Mm. So that kind of started me down that path. But I think exercise generally is my life hack. Mm.
That's what keeps you going.
It keeps me going.
Yeah. It's extraordinary, isn't it, how if you expend more energy, you actually get more energy back in.
Yeah.
You think that you've become more tired, but actually you become more energised. Now, this sort of brings us on really to the second half of the podcast. And as I mentioned earlier, I really got to know Niamh through this trip that we did up to Scotland together. And we were sitting in the bar with our glasses of water and a glass of something else, I expect, having a chat. And I was just finishing my Good Menopause Guide book. So I was just doing the last bits and pieces on the proofs before it was going off to the printers. And so we had this menopause discussion, and you know, what you told me really sparked something which I'm now investigating further, and that is this whole area of mental health and anxiety and depression and low mood that doesn't get recognised as a menopausal symptom or even perimenopause. And I think what we're talking about here primarily is women who from their mid-40s still having periods, still not really even thinking about the menopause at all, frankly, because that's, you know, you just think, well, that's a way off. That's you know, that's for much older ladies who have no periods, and that's not me. But of course, as we know, as our estrogen declines, that is the perimenopause period, which can be 5, 6 or more years before our actual menopause. And that's what can affect our mental health. So tell me your story, and let's just, I'm going to frame this in a context here. We mentioned your husband earlier. Your husband is a consultant psychiatrist.
He is. Okay. He is. He specialises in old age psychiatry, but you have to be a general psychiatrist first before
live and have lived for many years.
Very happily.
Very happily with somebody who is the top of the psychiatric tree in terms of care and diagnosis and recognition. Okay, so it's important to put that into that framework.
Yeah.
So tell us your story.
Yeah, that's the backstory. So where do I start? I think I kind of coped with them. I mean, you talk about the perimenopausal years, and I think it was almost masked by me and my personality. It wasn't until I almost came into fully fledged menopause that it got so bad that I kind of woke up to there's something being very wrong. Mm. So, you know, I'm very up and down anyway. I kind of get very sad and I get happy, and I cope by things like exercise, meditation, you know, all of those things I use as coping mechanisms. So I probably coped my way through the early years of menopause. And then it wasn't till almost my period stopped completely that I just felt like I'd literally lost the plot.
So what happened? What were your symptoms?
I think it's a gradual thing, obviously, but I couldn't think straight. My running, I used to be able to run half a marathon without doing an awful lot in preparation for it, because I'm fit and well and I'm running constantly. I could hardly run, you know, a 5K. I was exhausted. I wasn't sleeping. My sleep, I think, was my lack of sleep was my biggest catalyst for going to see somebody. I was literally at one point waking up every hour. So seeing every single hour, and then of course, as we all know, you know, sleep deprivation just leads to all sorts of awful stuff during the day.
And what about the low mood? I mean, how did that affect you?
I was more crazy mood than low mood.
Was it?
I remember once my husband was like, you know, 5 minutes late for going up to London to go and see my sister. And I was bashing on his office door.
The rage, the anger. This is something that I hear.
And the anger, the intolerance, you know, for a very... when I look back on it, it feels crazy. And I'm kind of laughing now, almost tearful with amusement about it. At the time, it felt so real and so...
And you can see why so many marriages and relationships fall apart at that stage of life.
And, you know, I remember reading around menopause and people, you know, they nearly lost their minds. Really? You know, I don't think that'll be happening to me anytime soon.
Yeah, I'm an intelligent, rational...
I'm intelligent. We have a very loving relationship built, you know, that sort of stuff. There was so much. And yet, you know, you can be right in the middle of that stuff and it can be so crazy and so, but it still feels very real.
And did you
feel
burst
very
into
rational.
Tears? Did you?
I burst into tears very regularly towards the end before I started acting on my symptoms and getting some outside help.
For what reason? What would trigger
for
it?
For no reason, Liz.
No reason.
So there was one story where, you know, Andy and I woke up on Saturday morning just in bed. There was nothing wrong with my day. You know, the sun was coming in through the windows. And I was in tears. Just floods of tears.
So what did he think? Because as a psychiatrist, next to somebody that he knows well and loves and cares about, what was his first reaction to that?
His first thought certainly wasn't menopause. I remember saying to him, do you think I'm depressed? Do you think your colleagues would think I'm depressed? I mean, the trouble with, you know, being in a relationship with that kind of fellow medically trained person is that you're almost too close to everything, you know. So bless him, I don't think he could figure it out. He knew there was something different. He knew there was something not right, and not right with our relationship or where I was. But neither of us could figure it out.
So at what point did you go and see, presumably you didn't go and consult him, you went to GP?
No, I did a lot of reading, and then I went to a GP, and my GP was very well-meaning, but, you know, didn't know an awful lot about menopause.
And were they looking at you for depression at that stage?
They were certainly initially, my initial phone consultation, that was the direction of travel.
Right, so were they thinking antidepressants? I mean, what was the course of action?
I think they would have certainly given me antidepressants if I... Yeah. You know, without very much pushing back, they would have prescribed antidepressants very quickly. But I kind of had this second sense of knowing that this wasn't this wasn't what it was. You know, there was just more to it. But it was that not knowing what you don't know, because I there was a manicness and craziness, and I wasn't sleeping. And
at what point did the penny drop? And you thought,
I started reading.
Did you?
I started reading, which is often my beginning of my, you know, so I was frantically Googling and searching, and you know, my libido had gone, just felt like it was coming in myself, and I kept saying that, kept bursting into tears. Andy knew there was something wrong, but we couldn't quite put it, you know.
And of course, being evidence-based, you said that earlier in the conversation with your pharmacy background, presumably you were looking at all the medical trials and the studies and the information, and what conclusions did you draw as to what was out there for you?
Yeah, and then I kind of retrospectively realised my dear mother, who isn't around anymore, she had a very difficult menopause. I was a lot younger, obviously, so I kind of didn't take it on board, but I remember at the time, it was before the HRT scare, actually, so she was on HRT, and I think... it was all behind closed doors. Obviously, Irish Catholic Ireland was even more behind closed doors than anything. But it was. But I did. I kind of remember that. And I was on a. My sisters and I tried to get together every year for a little kind of just a weekend. And I was talking to my sisters quite openly about it. And I remember them saying, "Actually, Mum had a really difficult menopause."
Okay.
And then I
does
started.
Does it tend to go in
it does,
families? Does
yes,
it? So it's
absolutely.
Interesting to have a conversation
so actually,
with your mother
if you're able to
if you're in that position.
Yeah. So that was quite interesting. And then I just started digging around and, as you say, looking at symptoms and then joining the dots.
And
back
did you take
there.
HRT from the onset, or did you look at other things?
I looked at
journey?
Other things to start with.
And what sort of things did you try?
And I looked at the bioequivalent estrogen. And
is that the one that's compounded in an unregulated pharmacy?
Yeah.
Why would you go to an unregulated pharmacy?
No, this is prescription.
Oh, okay, this is the body identical.
It's the body identical picking me up on things. I should know that. It's a long time ago. So estrogen, progesterone, and then a little bit of testosterone. So I manage all that myself, kind of independently.
And your GP can give that to you?
No, my GP didn't give that to me.
Right.
I fought a bit harder and got to see a consultant nurse practitioner, actually, down in Poole, who knew everything there is to know about the menopause.
How very interesting.
I remember sitting down and thinking, this is somebody I can really talk to about all of this, who really gets it. And so we adjusted doses and we worked it out. And we kind
and
of
do you use the estrogen gel? Or
I
the
use
patch?
The estrogen gel because then it doesn't go through the first pass liver metabolism.
That's right. I think, exactly.
So I'd obviously read around that.
Yeah, so not having the tablets. I mean, I think for
tablets.
Some they can be fine, but there is a slightly increased risk, isn't there, of having...
There
because
is.
Of the clotting factors
yes.
in the
yeah.
in,
I mean, probably
in the
not so much in my case, but I just wanted
no.
to, I thought this,
sure.
I'm going to be on this for a few years, so I want to kind of get it right. And then we can, the other thing about doing the doses individually, or the formulations individually, is that you can adjust the dose.
Yes,
accordingly,
so you can have a,
which
more,
suited
more or
me.
Less of
it
the
won't,
gel.
It won't yep. suit everybody.
Yeah. And then the progesterone.
The progesterone
to go with
I take.
It.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is again the body identical.
Yes, the body
one,
identical.
And
then the testosterone, which of course isn't even licensed in this country.
Now this
yet.
Is extraordinary, and I'm going to be talking to Meg Matthews, and I know that we're going to be having a long
Brilliant.
Chat about testosterone, because she's very keen on that. Did you start taking all three together?
No.
Or did you
no.
start with
no.
estrogen and the progesterone?
No. Started with the estrogen and progesterone. It took us a while to get the estrogen right, in fact.
Yeah, that's very encouraging for women to know that actually it's not kind of a one-size-fits-all. So if
no.
it isn't right for you,
no.
you may need to go back and have doses adjusted.
Or... Very much so.
And how quickly was it before you saw any kind of difference?
Weeks.
Really? Quite fast?
Literally.
Did you stop crying?
And that
crying?
Was before I stopped crying.
That's good.
I started sleeping a bit better, although I still... Yeah. have to get up in the night a couple of times, and you know, yeah. I drink a lot of water during the day, so
right.
I'm doing wee. But I am sleep. I've got a much better handle on, and of course that then you know feeds through to the next day. So the estrogen and progesterone took probably about 6 months to get right, and I think you know from a prescriber's point of view, they're reluctant to mix it up with testosterone
until you've got
until
that balance.
You've got the
yeah.
right
yeah.
dose, because testosterone is sort of the icing on the cake a bit, I think,
right,
you know.
So Liz, tell us about that. So why did you decide to then add in testosterone into the
again
mix?
I did a lot of reading. I still yeah. wasn't sleeping. It just still felt like there was something we could do here that wasn't right. My libido, I find, and my energy were still really low. So
did it affect clarity of thought and
oh god
mental
yeah.
awareness?
Yeah, totally.
That's what I've read about.
Yeah. Yeah, and energy, you know, again with my running is a good benchmark, because actually, you know, I know when I've got...
Well, you know exactly how
energy.
Far you can
how far
go,
I can
don't
run,
you? You can measure
I can
it.
Measure how fast
yeah.
I can do that.
Yeah,
and then, so that
yeah.
was a good, you know, yardstick for monitoring. All of that helped. And they are, I think, certainly in the UK, they're still very reluctant. I mean, there isn't even a formula for women. You have to use a gel.
The male,
you know,
one.
Gradually.
But that doesn't mean it's unsafe for women. It just
oh,
means
it's not
they
unsafe.
Haven't...
No, it's
I was taught
it's, very
it's,
safe. It's just difficult to get the dose right.
Yes. And I was talking to somebody in the medical world who said that the reason that testosterone, in their opinion, isn't licensed for women specifically, is that it's actually a very cheap drug to make. So there's not a particular
there's no
big
money in it.
Money in it.
So
and to get a medical license for you know, a women's health issue that isn't life-threatening potentially, you know, where's the incentive? So which
it's
is
interesting,
which is
though,
rather
I wonder,
sad, isn't it, if
I wonder
the case.
If, yes, and I wonder if it was, you know, the male population in the same position, just to be a little bit antagonistic.
Yeah.
I wonder, would we get the same pushback?
Oh my goodness,
you know,
no.
Well,
well
we know
there,
the answer
for heaven's
is
sake.
No,
I mean, it's,
I know,
you know,
I know.
Is that a life-threatening
no.
condition?
And as far as I know, it's licensed in the US.
And also Australia.
Australia.
And I think there is a new import coming in from Australia, which is an Australian product, which has gone through all the licensing.
But you think this
for women.
Is half the population. I mean, not everybody will need testosterone. But,
no, sure.
You know, it is.
Yeah.
There's a big, huge sample population of women that would, you know, would benefit from it.
Well, I just think it's really interesting that we do continue to talk about it. There's been a lot more in the media that has started the conversation.
Yeah.
And also just not to be talking about hot flushes as important as they are, but to really understand that this whole area of anxiety and debilitating depression and, you know, so much so that people stop working, they stay indoors, they don't travel, you know, they lose their social life, their relationships.
Confidence.
So
it is
compromised.
It is.
And when you're in that brain fog, it's actually quite hard, isn't it,
to
see your way out
it
of it and to make a rational decision. So in some ways, some of the doctors I've spoken to have said that they want to get this message out to younger women. So the minute they hit their, you know, even early to mid-40s and start to sense changes, at least they're aware.
Yes.
That, oh, this might be my hormones.
Yeah.
Maybe I should go and have a chat with my GP, or, as you say, a menopause nurse or specialist or somebody like that. And flag it.
Yes.
Rather than just think at that time of life, oh, I've got, you know, all these kids, or I've got a stressy job, or I'm travelling, or my relationship's in trouble, or whatever, and all these other factors that we might confuse and think that's what's making us feel so down.
I know. There is no norm, you know.
And that's the problem also, is that none of us are the same, are they? You know, we're all
different.
No,
I know, but
identical.
there is no background noise. There's nothing.
No.
There's no, you know, I was amazed, because I did have to dig down and I did have to read around, and people don't want to talk about it, you know? Mm. I think people just need to, it just needs to be normalised.
It does.
It needs to become, rather than this taboo, you know, area, it needs to be normal.
Just a normal stage of life. We talk about puberty.
It's just the next stage of the journey, you know? Yeah. It's not getting old and ancient. It's just the next stage of our journeys.
Getting old and staying well. Niamh, it's such a delight to have you. Thank you for taking the trouble and the time to share your amazing experiences and hopefully a little bit of helpful information, food for thought. And so as we wrap up here, no pun intended, haha, thank you so much for tuning in. I do hope that what we've been talking about has been helpful. Do click the subscribe button on your podcast app on your phone, and that will make sure that the next episode gets downloaded safely. But as always, you can download the podcast notes from today's broadcast on lizarwellbeing.com. And I think that's particularly important because we've obviously covered a lot of things. It's going to be a very interesting podcast note sheet because it'll be half filled with how to buy the most amazing cashmere and what to look for and how to look after it, and half filled with lots of help for hormones and depression and anxiety. So as always, on those notes you'll also find the latest news and some recipe ideas and offers and wellbeing events, including actually quite a few focusing on the menopause coming up. You'll find a couple of the books I've written on the menopause over on Amazon. So until the next time we chat, go well. Bye bye.